Joining us this morning is Terry Messier. She is a hummingbird rehabber in Southern California. She helps hummingbirds when they get hurt. And she's the author of a book called Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood. Good morning, Terry, and welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. This is a fascinating book. I've been reading through it, and I think anybody who enjoys reading books about the natural world would be intrigued by this. And, you know, I'm one of those people. I've always enjoyed watching hummingbirds, but I've never given much thought to what they are other than how fast their wings flap. Tell me a little bit about how you got involved in this. What's the story about behind you becoming a hummingbird rehabber?
Well, I was living in Los Angeles, and two young hummingbirds came to me under unusual circumstances. The first one in 2003, my Abyssinian cat escaped from the house during a Santa Ana windstorm and brought home a pin-feathered nestling and brought it in the house and just set it on the floor. It was completely undamaged. And I knew it was a hummingbird, but I didn't know anything else about hummingbirds either. And so I called around and found a rehabber. And then the following spring, a nestling was washed out of his nest in front of our house during a torrential downpour in 2004. So I had to climb a ladder in my wool suit. I was on my way to teaching my class at UCLA, and I climbed a ladder out in this torrential downpour and dislodged him from the nest, and then took him back to the rehabber, and that was it. I was hooked when I saw her set up and started driving for her. So it was a kind of a destiny in a way.
Now, what is the rehabbing process? Do the hummingbirds go to a vet first and then come to you for rehabbing? How does that work?
Actually, vets don't know very much about hummingbirds. Most of them don't know any more than the average citizen does. So they come straight to us because we learn through experience, and we're trained by other rehabbers before we start. So if we need veterinary assistance, we can get it from avian experts. But generally, we do most of the work ourselves, and then they come in and the babies start in an ICU, and then they pass through a very rigorous educational process, different sizes of cages, and finally to an outdoor aviary before they're released back into the wild.
And when you release them back into the wild, do you need to release them in the area they were found, or can you just let them go anywhere?
We have to release them from the rehab center because they are impossible to catch. And it's very dangerous once they get to be adults to try to catch them because their wings, you know, their wings spin 60 to 100 times per second, and they can fly faster than your eye can follow. So we can't possibly catch them to let them go elsewhere. So 99% of them are released from the center. If we get an adult female that was injured and can be rehabbed within a day, we take her back to her home territory in case she had a nest.
Well, that kind of brings me to the next question. Give us some facts about hummingbirds, because they are fascinating creatures, but you're right. Most of us know very little about them.
Yeah, they like I said, their wings are like science fiction. They spin in a figure eight pattern between 60 to 120 times per second, depending on the species. Most of them weigh less than a nickel, some weigh less than a penny. And even with that slight weight, they can migrate up to 7,000 miles a year. And they are incredibly beautiful. As you know, the males have a bright gorget around their neck, and the females just have a little spot in the center in most species. So those are some of the basics.
And what's their range in North America? Where do you find hummingbirds?
They're everywhere in the U.S. And Canada. And most of the northern birds are Anas because they're the heavyweights. They come in at 4 grams, so they're the heavyweights of the hummingbird world. And they can take the winter up in Portland now. I have some staying at my feeders up in Portland, but it really takes a tough individual. Most of them have to migrate south. So we have Anas up in the northern northwest, Pacific Northwest in Canada. The Rufus flies from Mexico to Alaska and back every year to migrate to from their winter grounds to their nesting area. And then the ruby-throated are basically the primary hummingbird east of the Mississippi.
And Southern California must be a pretty desirable climate for them.
Oh, it's perfect. And they're, you know, the Southern Californians are in love with their hummers, so they put feeders out. There are sugar feeders everywhere, and we've planted so much introduced vegetation that's designed specifically to attract them. So we have probably 7 species here. It's really a beautiful mix.
You talk about the hummingbird network of rehabbers. How did this network come to be?
It's a pretty loose network. They're just individuals who started doing it kind of because they are volunteers who love birds, love animals. So it's not, we all are under different umbrellas usually. We work under different permits, but we all know each other because when people call us, we try to direct the finders to the closest location.
You mentioned a little bit, you touched on what's involved in rehabilitation. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's really a long process. Hummingbirds grow very quickly, but they have to learn skills if they lose their mother. So a lot of babies come from tree trimmers, unfortunately. We're trying to teach people not to trim trees in the spring because that's when the birds are nesting. And all, you know, it's not just hummingbirds, but all birds get cut out of their trees. When we get babies, that are still in the nest, we put them in an ICU, like a little incubator. And once they can fly, they move into a small flight cage with a roommate. Sometimes they like the roommate, sometimes they hate them.
So just like real life, right?
Exactly. Just like college, just like marriage. there's a certain amount of reshuffling necessary. And then once they learn their basic flight skills, like flying vertically and backwards and doing a 360 rotation in midair, we move them into a larger flight cage where they learn more advanced skills, like flips and spins and flying around hovering. And they get some plants, and then finally they move into an aviary with 15 or 20 other young adults, and they have a tree, and they have their feeders and a bird bath. And this is a simulated reality that prepares them for release into the wild. The outdoor birds are right outside the bars, so they can see them and watch the outdoor world before we let them go.
We're speaking this morning with Terry Messier. She is a hummingbird rehabber from Southern California. She's written a book called Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood. We'll be back right after the break to take your questions. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Milt Radford, filling in today for Jeffrey Riley. We're speaking this morning with Terry Messier. She is the author of a book entitled Fastest Things on Wings. She is a hummingbird rehabber, and we'll go to some of your questions now. We have John in Grants Pass. Go ahead, John.
Hi. Thanks. My wife loves hummingbirds. She has feeders all over the place. Just love them, and they are amazing. So I'd like any advice about where to hang, where's the best place to put the feeders, how high or low. I don't know anything about the mix because she does it. Any advice about the sugar water or anything else you can think of that we might be interested in?
Yeah, the most important thing about feeders is to keep them clean. So that depends on where you are. In Southern California, it really means every 3 days you need to empty and clean them. And I've been living in Portland for a while, and I've noticed that, especially this summer because it's been so warm, I have had to do my feeders up there every 3 days. They like them high. The higher, the better. So balconies are great, and it keeps them away. That keeps them away from domestic predators, like especially cats and, you know, anything that's running around that we have introduced, right? And then, often one hummingbird will try to dominate all the feeders. You've probably noticed that. So it's best to put them out of the line of vision of each other and put them on different sides of the house, because that way one bird or two birds can't dominate all of the feeders.
You mentioned hanging them up high. Is there anything else that we can do to, other than feeding them, to make it safer in our backyards for hummingbirds?
That's the main thing. We get a certain number of window strikes, and there are little decals. If you have a window that seems to be causing that kind of trouble, you can put little pasted decals on the window that reflect ultraviolet light and warn the birds off from those windows. But other than that, they're generally good at taking care of themselves as long as we stay out of the way.
Yeah. Where do you get a decal like that?
I get them on the internet. You can just look up window decals for birds, and there are all kinds of them. They're kind of transparent, so they look a little funny, but you can get any design. You can get hummingbird designs or any design that you want to put on the window. And you know, some people will tell me, "I have this window; the birds hit it all the time." I would say, "Yeah, you should put the decals on that." But most windows, they pretty much stay away from.
And I guess that would help any bird that may have that problem.
Exactly. I mean, you know, birds are always, I live right by the forest and near Forest Park, and birds are always hitting, the doves are always hitting windows too, so, yeah.
Well, let's go to Jeannie in Medford with a question. Go ahead, Jeannie.
Hi, bless you for your work.
Thank you.
In my past, I've rescued a great horned owl, and my boss said, "You better hope that son of a gun don't wake up," because he just got stunned. And I had him wrapped in a winter muffler on the way to meet the rescue people. I was looking at those talons or claws. Oh, Lord, maybe I made a mistake.
Yeah, they're tough guys. You got to make sure that those are kind of held or bound some way when you pick them up.
Yeah, I am wrapped.
But believe it or not, you don't have to worry.
Two baby pigeons and my cat, I said, no. And when they got bigger, they would chase my cat's toys, like the ball that rolled. And I just love what you're doing. I never went full board with it, but I know that feeling. And my question about hummingbirds, I believe in California it was that I was always told, do not put out the red sugar feeders.
The red dye, yeah.
Oh, is that true then? Because it encouraged them not to migrate.
It doesn't really stop them from migrating, but the red dye is not really good for their liver and their we don't usually use as much red dye as we used to because there was a red dye scare in the 70s for humans, and the red dye does go all through their system, so their digestive system, so it's really unnecessary. They know what a red feeder looks like, and they don't look at the color of the liquid at all. They just go for those red feeders. So the Percupet feeders with the red bases are best. You know, a glass feeder with a plastic red base will attract them. And so the red dye is totally unnecessary and maybe somewhat harmful to them.
Thanks, Jeannie, for your question. Terry, I was reading in your book that some people who are meaning well can feed hummingbirds the wrong kind of protein. Can you talk a little bit about that? And also, with the sugar feeders that we have, is there some kind of protein supplement that we should be adding to that?
Okay, yeah. No, they don't need any protein supplement in their feeders, first of all, because they eat fruit flies, they eat 200 to 300 fruit flies a day, and they're expert hunters. They're really good at catching fruit flies and mosquitoes, so we don't need to supplement their diet. You can see that most of them are very pudgy and round because they're well fed on mosquitoes,
yeah,
and arthropods, and some people believe that they can eat anything. You probably read all the crazy things that people give hummingbirds babies when they find them, but that one of the most detrimental things is ants or anything with a hard exoskeleton because they can't digest those insects. All insects are not alike. Arthropods have a soft skeleton. Ants have a hard exoskeleton, and that's what they breathe through. And consequently, if people feed a baby hummingbird ants, it normally dies. And unfortunately, this happens several times every year. So we're trying to educate people about that. They do not eat ants. Even when the ants are on the feeder, they won't pick them off.
Hmm. We're speaking this morning with Terry Mazier. She is the author of the book Fastest Things on Wings. She has a lot of great experiences in here as a hummingbird rehabber and the work that she does. You mentioned earlier that veterinarians don't really treat hummingbirds. Is there some kind of resistance to this?
To treating hummingbirds?
Yes.
No, not really. There's just no profit in it. You know, the hummingbirds are wards of the state, so to speak. They belong to California or to Oregon, and so when you find a hummingbird, it's not your bird, and a vet, you know, cannot legally charge you to treat that bird, but unfortunately some veterinarians will try to charge individuals. But essentially, vets just don't know very much about hummingbirds. You have to be an avian specialist, and vets call me all the time and ask me what they should do. So they're very specific. Their needs are specific, and they're very different from other birds. So even if you are an avian specialist in veterinary work, you may not know anything about hummingbirds. So basically, they don't treat them because there's no profit to be made, and it's best for them to get the hummingbirds to us because we know far more than they do.
Let's go to Bill and Eugene. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi, I have two questions. First off, I heard that there's a feeder on the market that actually continuously drips, so it's completely empty in 3 days, so there's no problem with bacteria building up, and I wonder if she heard of that, and if it is, she knows the name. And then the other thing is I heard that certain types of the time of the year, or maybe it's certain places or combination, that you should not feed them because they'll stick around and not migrate and they'll get killed in the weather because they don't head south soon enough.
Okay, yeah. I'll get back to the first question in a minute. Your second question is an urban myth. Hummingbirds won't. They never fail to migrate just because they have a feeder. If they need to migrate, they'll migrate. And if anything, the feeders allow them to, you know, to eat on their migratory journeys and to keep enough sugar water around is helpful for them. But they really migrate when they feel the need. The Southern California hummingbirds don't migrate and wouldn't migrate even if they didn't have feeders because they've got so much food here. So don't worry about that. I have heard that before. People will say, when it's snowing now and the hummingbird's still here, I should take the feeder down. That's the absolute worst time to take the feeder down because he's depending on it at that point. So, you know, we want to help them rather than try to give them tough love. They'll figure it out. The first part of your question, I'm a little concerned. I haven't heard of that feeder, but it would concern me, the drip would concern me about attracting ants, because whenever sugar water drips anywhere, you're going to get a lot of ants around that area. So I haven't heard of it, but I don't know if they've figured out a way to solve that problem.
All right, Bill, thanks for your question. How do you control them during the rehabilitation process? You talked about the aviary and how they're, you know, we've all seen hummingbirds and how fast they move. Is that a concern when they've been injured?
In terms of their speed or?
Their speed or, you know, if they've been injured in some way, can they build up too much speed and run into something while they're rehabilitating?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. No, we don't really get injuries in rehab because we have a perfect setup where the cages are soft-sided or wire mesh, and then the larger cages are a galvanized wire, and the wire's pretty, it's not really, really hard. So sometimes they will get into fights in the aviary and may get injured, but I've never had one get really injured in rehab. And if one of them starts to fight too much, which occasionally you'll get a male that just wants to run everything and starts fighting, you throw him out because he's ready for the real world.
We're speaking this morning with Terry Mazier. She has written a book called Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood. It's stories that she has of birds that have been rescued and rehabilitated. If you would like to ask Terry a question, give us a call on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. Talking about these injuries, what are the main causes for hummingbird injury that you see?
We get it, first of all, as I mentioned earlier, we get a lot of rescues because of tree trimmers and weekend gardeners, and, you know, often the babies can't be put back because their tree has been taken down or it's too exposed. We get a lot of cat caughts, unfortunately. Domestic cats are good at what they do, and window strikes, but often window strikes can be solved over the phone. And then a lot of trapped birds, trapped in garages, trapped in houses, those also can be solved over the phone. And automobile accidents, just yesterday I had one that hit a car. So those are the most common injuries.
If a person finds an injured or stressed hummingbird, what should they do? And maybe more importantly, what shouldn't they do?
Good question. Every situation is unique, and our first impulse is to pick up the bird and bring it home, but often young fledglings will get out of the nest maybe a day too early, and they'll be on the ground for a day or two, and people want to pick them up and take them home and rescue them, but in fact the mother's still there feeding the baby. So in those cases, people should call us right away from that place. Now that everyone has a cell phone, they can call us right away, and we build a little phone nest and just get him up off the ground and put him back up in a tree, and she will continue to feed him. If it's an injured adult, of course, he needs to go straight to rehab. But the first thing we do is have people feed them a little sugar water and see if they can get up and go in a half an hour. If they can't, then they come into rehab. But each case is so unique, so we really encourage people to call us from the site rather than take the bird out of its natural environment. And I understand the temptation to bring it home. It's our protective impulse, but unfortunately it breaks the bonds with the mother, and then we can't get them back, and then it's 8 weeks in rehab. So.
And Joan and Eugene has a question about sugar. Go ahead, Joan.
Hello, yes. I was concerned about the type of sugar to use in the feeders because I was thinking that pesticides and GMOs wouldn't be good for the birds. So I just give them fuchsia plants. I put out fuchsia plants every year.
Yeah, the sugar doesn't seem to harm them. They're thriving with all the feeders that we've put up across the country. The hummingbirds are really thriving. Their populations are exploding. So it's great because they're one of the species that can really live with us and profit from our help. And so the cheapest white sugar you can find is the best. No organic, nothing special. They just like regular white sugar, and it seems to be fine. Our birds, you know, banders are finding that birds that live in cities are living, you know, 10 to 12 years. So it's obviously not hurting them.
Yeah. Just like us. We like white sugar, too, but it's probably not.
Yeah.
It's not doing us any good.
We're, you know, we're very much like them. We love our sugar, but we need our protein, right?
Which brings up a question. Before human beings were starting to interact with hummingbirds, I mean, there were no feeders back in the day with sugar water in it. What do hummingbirds do to get that sugar?
Well, they love tubular plants, and they have evolved over millions of years to take advantage of these tubular plants, and hence the long beak of the hummingbird, and they can get nectar from things like lavender and honeysuckle, plants like that really weren't that widespread in the country until humans moved in and started introducing them. So that's one of the reasons hummingbirds have propagated so much and exploded in terms of their numbers, because of all the vegetation we've introduced that's helpful to them. So they have evolved this rich evolutionary niche between insects and other birds that you know secures a food source for them that no other birds can get to.
We have an email question from Scott in Ashland. He says, we have Anna's hummingbirds that winter over in Ashland. Mm-hmm. In the colder months when nothing is blooming, I've noticed them appearing to feed in spruce trees and other conifers. Are they feeding on the sap of the trees?
Yes, they are. They when they get desperate, that's not their first choice, but when they get desperate in the winter, they will lick the tree sap. Yeah, and they also can get insects that are sometimes looking for tree sap. So that's what they're after. Yes, he's right.
A question that popped into my mind about trimming trees, and you mentioned how spring is problematic for them. Are because of the size of hummingbirds, are the nests also really small? Are they hard to see in the trees?
Yes, the nests are tiny. They're about the size. If you put it in the palm of your hand, it would just fit in the very center of the palm of your hand. It's about 2 to 3 inches in diameter, and it has two babies. And when one baby falls out of the nest, which the younger one, the younger male, often gets kicked out of the nest by the older female if it gets too small, if the mother didn't build it elastic enough, people can't find the nest. And sometimes it's right in front of them, and it'll be right in front of their eyes, and they just look and look, and then finally a day later they'll say, wow, I just walked out there and it was right there. It was there all the time and I just didn't see it.
And like a lot of other species, when it's time to think about love, these males can be pretty aggressive with one another, can't they?
The males are, I was just speaking about this last night. Male hummingbirds do not help with the babies at all. They have one purpose in life, and that is to breed. And they are the worst playboys on the planet. They will breed with every female they can find, and they will fight, really fight hard to get a territory secured so that they can get all the females in that territory. So it's a war against all in the male hummingbird world.
Is there a way to check trees before you trim them, other than, I don't know, maybe sending a skinny teenager to scurry up the tree and look around?
It's pretty hard to see, to find the nest. The best way is to watch the tree and see if a bird's coming in and out, because the mother has to feed the babies every 30 minutes. So, you can easily see a bird coming in and out of a tree. But it's just pretty hard. Sometimes people just don't know. And it's just best to avoid trimming the trees in the spring because, there are hundreds of nests that we get every year, unfortunately, because of this bad habit.
We're speaking with Terry Mazier this morning. She has written a book called Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood. We're talking about a network of people who rehabilitate hummingbirds, and rehabbers they're called, and send them back out into the wild. We'll be back to take your questions and comments, but first we have a short break. Back right after this. Our guest this morning is Terry Mazier. She is a hummingbird rehabber, and she has written a book called Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood. She's here to take your questions and give us some insight into these fascinating little birds. If you would like to join the conversation, if you have a question about them, give us a call, 800-838-3760, or as always, jx@jeffnet.org with your questions. Does California specifically have the highest percentage of hummingbirds in America?
I'm pretty sure it does, yes. There are so many hummingbirds here. I'm in Los Angeles right now, and you can't walk down the street without seeing them. You walk out on the balcony, and they're fighting right outside the window. We have released over 10,000 healthy young adults into California, into Los Angeles, over the last 20 years. We save 500 birds a year through rehab and another 500 over the phone every year. So all of this rescue work has paid off. It's been a wildly successful conservation effort, and it has allowed the several species to propagate and to become a very, very present in everyday life. So I believe it does. I have never been to any other city in America or any place in the world where you can walk down the street and see hummingbirds anywhere.
For someone who's deeply involved in rehabbing like yourself, how many hours in a week can you spend doing something like this, and does it vary by season?
Yes, it's starting earlier and earlier because of the warm weather that we have down here now. We used to start in March. Now we start in January. The babies are coming in January, so the season has lengthened from 4 months to six. So we go from January through July, and rehabbers put in 15-hour days. The babies have to be fed every 30 minutes, and when you get 50, 60 birds on the property, you're looking at a lot of feeders that have to be filled, a lot of emotional and physical therapy for the injured birds, and it's your life.
So this is another example of climate change having an impact on species and migration times.
I believe it is. In this case, it doesn't seem to be particularly negative, though. They seem to be having more babies and starting earlier in the year. This also may be because what we're seeing down here is a hybridization of the rufous, which are Pacific Northwest birds, and the Allens hummingbirds, which came over from the Channel Islands in the 1980s. And I believe that they are hybridizing, and hence the population explosion of those types of birds. So it doesn't seem to be negatively impacting them at this point.
Plus, the warmer weather is probably increasing their survival rate, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think they're benefiting in a funny way from the change, but I don't think they would do so well without us, because of course the drought would not be conducive to their lives. But because we have artificially introduced watering practices, that helps them.
Elizabeth is on the line from Grants Pass. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Hi, Milt and Terry. This is such a wonderful subject. I'm a hummingbird lover, and I also have hummingbirds that overwinter. And I have a couple of really helpful comments. Over the summer, I cover the feeder on the screw-on top, the little cap, and the hook that you hang it with.
Yes.
I cover that with a little olive oil or a vegetable oil, and that prevents any ants.
You can use that or Vaseline, and those get rid of the ants. So,
absolutely, and that takes care of the ant problem for sure.
Yep.
And then over the winter, I also cover the, the glass tube with, that foam that you use on pipes in the winter.
Right, to insulate, yeah.
Yeah, and that prevents it from freezing.
Yeah, no, those are good insights. Some people put little warm lights on their feeders because they do freeze up in Portland. I know not last winter we didn't have any snow, but the winter before that, I had two hummers. I was out there brushing the snow off the feeders. You probably saw that, had that problem as well. But yeah, that will insulate and keep them warm, so those are good insights.
We have pretty warm weather in the winter compared to a lot of places, like in Grants Pass, so I would imagine that hummingbirds could overwinter here pretty easy compared to some places, I would think.
Yeah, the anas can. The rufous can't take it. They just can't take the cold. They're too small, and they lose heat too rapidly. There are a few robust anas that are making headway up into the northern climates and staying all year round now.
We have a comment from a caller who didn't want to be identified, but said that you should not use honey. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Honey's too viscous. Brown sugar also is terrible. Both of those are too viscous, and they stick in the hummingbird's crops and are just not good for them. Yeah.
You mentioned that hummingbirds are all over the U.S. Does that include the East Coast? Do you have different species over there?
Yes, east of the Mississippi, the ruby-throated hummingbird is the primary bird, and they think researchers believe there are maybe 15 to 20 million ruby-throated hummingbirds, and they migrate from Canada and the eastern U.S. across the Gulf of Mexico on a 500-mile nonstop overnight flight to Mexico and back every year. So,
in one night?
One night. They fly 17 hours straight through the darkness, and they use the moon and the stars to navigate, and perhaps some other things that we don't know about. We think that they may have some ability to see ultraviolet light. So yes, they migrate. It's incredible. This little bird that weighs less than a nickel can fly 500 miles, and takes about 17 hours, and they burn off half of their body weight.
My goodness, and that's not much body weight to burn off, is it?
Right, they have to bulk up from their little 3 grams to a massive 6 before they leave the land. Yeah.
We've mentioned earlier some of the positive and negative things about human contact, obviously. If putting out the feeders can help them, but at the same time, trimming trees in the spring can be a disaster for a hummingbird. Are there any other ways that contact with humans affect them adversely?
I think mostly it's what we do in nature, the cutting of their...
Hello. And we're having a little bit of a problem there, a little bit of a breakup. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, let's try that again. Terry Messier.
Yes. Especially in Central America and even, you know, parts of the Gulf Coast in the U.S., those negatively impact hummingbirds. So in general, it's because of what we do with their environment, their plants and their trees that are the problems, yeah.
Fastest Things on Wings. It's the book written by Terry Messier. It's talking about rescuing hummingbirds in the Hollywood area when she was there. And a lot of great stories in here. Did you have anything in particular, a story that you wanted to share?
I have a passage that I could read you that's just pretty short, if you'd like.
Yes, please.
Okay. It's about the hummingbirds' personalities because, you know, hummingbirds often need physical therapy, but they need emotional therapy too. They have profound emotional lives, and they never forget anything. So I've had several rescue birds that have challenged all my preconceptions about their psychological and emotional capacities. And a couple of them, I did have a bird, Pepper, who in the book, who suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder after being attacked by an adult male in Griffith Park. And then Brad, of course, who wouldn't leave the aviary for 2 months because of a fear of crows. So I just want to read this passage. It's the beginning of chapter 12. If anyone had tried to explain the range and complexities of the hummingbird temperament to me before I started doing rescue, I would not have believed it. We expect our dogs and cats to have unique personalities. And individual differences in higher mammals like elephants and great apes have been well documented. But when we regard a creature as small and seemingly indistinct as a hummingbird, we don't usually reflect on whether a particular bird is fundamentally aggressive or shy, friendly or aloof, confident or insecure. And yet these variations exist. Even after several years of rehabilitating hummingbirds, I continue to be fascinated by the sometimes slight, other times immeasurable differences in their dispositions.
Are they generally territorial? If you put up a feeder, will you see the same small group of hummingbirds stay with you for month after month, or do they come and go?
In some parts of the country, they tend to come and go more when they're on their migratory treks. But in places like Southern California where they never leave, yeah, you can get a male hummingbird that will dominate a feeder for years. Some people will call me out of frustration and say, I've had this one hummingbird that won't let any of the hummingbirds eat out of the feeder, and he's been here for 3 years, and he chases everybody off. So I tell them, as I mentioned earlier, put the feeders on different sides of the houses so they're out of his line of vision, and then he can't do that.
We all love a free lunch, don't we?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, they got us working for them. You know,
right.
I don't know if you know, hummingbirds they originally were dinosaurs, and when you see the babies, they really look like miniature dinosaurs, and researchers now believe that hummingbirds have evolved from dinosaurs. So the dinosaurs didn't disappear, they just got smaller.
Much smaller.
But they kept their giant aggression, you know. So,
right.
Yeah.
If you'd like to speak with Terry, if you have a question for her about hummingbirds, her book is Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood. You can give us a call at 800-838-3760 or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. What's a good resource that people can find, besides reading your book, for learning more about hummingbirds?
Well, there are a lot of hummingbird societies and there's a hummingbird network on the internet. There are a lot of different groups that people can join to. There are citizen banding or citizen networks now where people can report the birds they see, and that helps us understand what species are moving into what different areas of the country, because the hummingbird world is constantly in flux. It's not a static situation. The species are constantly evolving and moving into different areas and different parts of the country where we've never seen them before. So, yeah.
So for different areas, you connect with these people, and is there like a point person in each area that tries to distribute the birds to whoever has availability and time?
You mean in rehab?
Yes, in rehab.
Yeah, I'm generally the point person because I'm the only one who has an internet website, losangeleshummingbirdrescue.org, and anybody can find me. I have six-year-old kids call me, so I'm easy to locate. And once people call me, then I can direct them to the rehabber that's closest to them because Los Angeles is huge. And, you know, most people don't want to drive an hour, although most people will. It's preferable to send them to someone very close. So we only have four or five hummingbird rehabbers in the entire city, but we can get you within 30 minutes of somebody.
So you mentioned that the hummingbirds are doing pretty well and they're increasing in numbers. Is that presenting some new challenges?
So far, not really. There always is some concern that when one species becomes more prominent, then another species will die out. But our records indicate in Southern California that the Allen's rufous species, which are increasing rapidly, don't seem to be affecting the Anna's and black tin populations. The Anna's are still we still get more Anna's every year than we thought. Than we had, 10 years ago. So far, no. Hummingbirds are really good for the environment. They pollinate plants and they eat insects. So what, they're doing their job, and so we want more of them.
We have a call from Star in Grants Pass about nectar. Go ahead, Star.
So helpful to me. I want to talk about the nectar that I create by boiling a cup of sugar with 4 cups of water. And that's the first part of my question. Should it be boiled? I've boiled it too long, I think, at times. And I think I remember reading that it should only boil a minute. What is the recipe for that?
Well, I think it's best if you just boil the water and then add the sugar to it. You don't even really need to boil the water if you change your feeders every few days. But if you're concerned about that, you can just boil the water first and then add the sugar so that the sugar doesn't get burned. Yeah.
We're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you, Terry, a question. Do you plan on doing this for some time to come, and is there a follow-up book in your future?
I hope to keep doing it. I am currently living in Portland, but I intend to come back to the Los Angeles area at least part of the year and do the rescue option because I just really miss it. It really gets in your blood, and you find that it's impossible to give it up. There's something about them. They're addictive. And I have another book that I've already written, but it's about cats.
See, that seems appropriate, I guess, on the other side, right?
Yeah, right. We're keeping a balance.
Right. Our guest has been Terry Mazier. She is a hummingbird rehabber, and she has worked in Southern California, in Portland now, and she helps hummingbirds when they get hurt. Her book is called Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood. Terry, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.